Why bother about Haiti? This was the richest French colony back in the 18th century, until 1791 at least. And now we all know that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So obviously, the Haitians have messed it up, and it's their problem. But really, saying that is only a distorted presentation of Haiti and of the Haitian people. And we'll see that Haiti does matter. I don't know if you're familiar with the history of Haiti, whether or not I should give you, in a nutshell, what happened in this country and explain both its particular place in history and the treatment it has received almost since its birth. Haiti was born of a slave revolution. It is a unique example in history, never occurred before, never has occurred since. In 1791, the slave revolted en masse, as they say, you know, it was a general revolt. And despite the fact that Napoleon sent his army in 1801 to try and reestablish slavery after the slave themselves had abolished it in 1794, despite Napoleon's great expedition led by his brother-in-law himself, the Haitian could not be stopped, and on January 1st, 1804, proclaimed independence. The Haitian Revolution, which, by the way, with the Cuban Revolution, is the only revolution to have occurred in America. The Haitian Revolution was, at the same time, an anti-racist revolution. It completely debunked the myth of racial superiority and of racial inferiority. It was an anti-slavery revolution, set everybody free with no exception. It was an anti-colonial revolution, and we could also say it was the beginning of anti-imperialism. Of course, such an event in the world of the time could not leave the powers that were indifferent. We have to remember that in their fight to gain independence, the Haitian slave beat the Spanish, the British, and the French, which means the greatest power of the time, powers who were both plundering colonies all over the world, held slaves, and also the new emerging power, the U.S., was also a country funded on slavery. So, of course, the news of the Haitian Revolution for them was a catastrophe, and they proceeded to isolate Haiti, blockade it, maybe worse than they've been doing to Cuba since the Cuban Revolution. And also, of course, maligning Haiti. You know, this started way back then, and it has continued. Yes, the Haitian did mess up, but who are the Haitians that messed up? Certainly not the Haitian peasant who've been working this land, you know, for almost 400 years, because they were the one working it back when it was the richest colony of France, and have worked it almost with their bare hand since independence, and have been the sole creator of wealth, even though they themselves never saw wealth because they were too busy working to make money, see? So on the Haitian side, those who messed up the country were the Haitian elites, those who had access to wealth and those who had access to knowledge and didn't want to share either the wealth or the knowledge. But we must say that they were not alone in ruining Haiti. They got outside help, and in a big way. First of all, Haiti is also the only country which, after having won its independence in a war that devastated the country and cost the life of a third of the population, had to actually pay the ex-exploiters, the ex-slave master, for having beaten them. Because in 1840, or around that time, France sent gunships to Haiti and threatened to invade and reestablish slavery, rather, unless it was paid the sum of 100 million francs of the time, which is a lot of money. It took Haiti 100 years to pay. 100 years. Of course, this was done with the complicity of the Haitian rulers of the time, who already were divorced from the masses, and since the masses were revolting against them, preferred to sign a truce with France and then be free to, if you want, fight the peasant rebellion that they were facing at the time. But that debt, that initial debt contracted by Haiti, was the equivalent of putting a 1 kilo bag of sugar, of whatever you want, on the shoulder of a 1-year-old baby. And no wonder that it stunted the development of Haiti and explains, in great part, the situation that Haiti is in now. But it didn't stop there, you see. All through the 19th century, European powers, who had by then their representatives in the country engaged in commerce, would send their gunship after every incident to extort huge compensation money for any losses incurred by their nationals living in the country. To top it all off, in 1915, the U.S. occupied Haiti in the name of what has been called the Monroe Doctrine, which stated that America was for the Americans and that European countries no longer had any influence in America. But when Monroe said America to the Americans, what he meant was America for the Yankees, because, of course, we also are American, living in that part of the world that's called America, and also so is Chile and Brazil and Argentina, etc. No, he meant strictly America for the USA. And that's how the US came to invade Haiti and occupy it for 20 years. Not only did they plunder it, but they completely destructured the Haitian peasant class, who were, by the way, the only one who stood up and fought the Marines. They were Haitian peasants. And that's where, you know, for the first time, planes were used against the population, against the guerrilla of the CACOs. That's the way they were called, these peasants who were fighting the American occupation. But not only did they do that, but they left us with a poison gift, which was this famous Haitian army, which was the exact opposite of the army of people, the people's army who had liberated the country. These were nothing but an occupying army replacing the Marines, you know? And the same approach was applied in every country that the U.S. occupied around that time. Take the Dominican Republic, which shared the islands with us. It was left with a National Guard led by Trujillo, who then became the dictator that maybe you've heard about. In Nicaragua, they created also a Guardia Nacional who was led by Mr. Somoza, who was the father of the Somoza that the Sandinista were able to overthrow. So you see, it was the same pattern. So this army was nothing but an occupying army. It behaved as such. Its enemy was the population of Haiti, and it always acted as an arm, a proxy of the U.S. And as such, almost as soon as the U.S. troops left, the army started acting as an arbiter of Haitian political life, repressing the population, repressing the peasant movement, the workers' movement, and making and breaking civilian president. Already in 1946, the army overthrew a president that, even though he had not been elected directly by the people, but practiced a policy that was, you know, sympathetic to the masses, he was overthrown and the army assumed power. Then, again, after that, the major who was leading the junta proclaimed himself president, etc., etc. The army again, in the first election, who were to be held by direct vote, rather than, you know, they had a system before where you would vote for a member of parliament and the members of parliament would designate the president. In 1957, for the first time, Haitians were going to elect the president directly by popular vote. Of course, the army wouldn't let it happen. First thing that they did, there was a candidate back then who was very popular, especially with the urban masses in Port-au-Prince. He was tricked into assuming a provisional presidency, and then, maybe 2 weeks later, he was overthrown, shipped into exile, and already, you know, the army did what we've seen happening more and more after President Aristide came in power. The army went into the popular neighborhood with heavy caliber machine gun and really did a terrible massacre. And that was that, you know, the popular movement at the time had to go, I'd say, underground. And the army installed Duvalier. Duvalier proved to be probably the worst dictator of Haitian history. He took repression to new heights. You know, under Duvalier, if you were suspected of plotting against the regime, of thinking against the regime, not only would you be hunted and killed, but so would your family. You know, and I'm talking about whole families from grandfather to infant being massacred to instill terror in the heart of everybody. And despite many attempts by small groups, because of course groups had to be small, because conspiracy was the only outlet you had if you wanted to change anything, these groups never were able to actually link up with the population, and the terror was such that this was extremely difficult. Despite all these attempts, Duvalier not only succeeded in naming himself president for life, but also at his death to name his son, 19 years at the time, president for life also. So we had invented the presidency for life as a hereditary system of government. Anyways, either Duvalier, father or the son, all enjoyed the full support of the US, of France, and Canada. Of course, Canada's was more an acceptance of the facts, but the US propped this dictatorship up. France also backed them up. But things were changing underground. A popular movement was slowly coming together. And in 86, there happened a conjunction between the Haitian masses getting fed up by this dictatorship, and there was a change in American foreign policy. American foreign policy in the region was based on installing dictatorships, usually military dictatorships, but it started changing around the 80s. The US then realized that it was a better system to have in these countries that were under its dominance, fake democracy, things that looked like democracy and that we can characterize as a polyarchy. This is exactly a system analogous to what you have in the US and that we have here also in Canada. That is when their only choice is to vote for one wing or the other of a very small group of professional politicians representing really the interests of the more powerful people in a society, you know, because when we look at the American system, we see that the American people have but one choice. It is truly not a multi-party that you have in the US. You have something that is called the Democrat and something that is called the Republicans, and that's it. Your choice is limited to that. And it turns from Republicans to Democrat, Republican to Democrat, and it's always the same policy. And this is what they wanted to impose on Haiti, Nicaragua, Philippines, because they realized that this was a better system to maintain than the dictatorship, which usually met with the people's resistance. And also, it's always better when you can standardize, right? You have the periphery, if you want, mimicking, built on the model of the center. So, the US wanted to install the system in Haiti in place of the dictatorship. But the Haitian people had a different idea. They wanted a true democracy, a regime in which not only would the people choose themselves, but also would a system that would bring about the changes that were vital if Haiti was to survive. Because one thing that few people know is the reality of the way wealth is shared or distributed in Haiti. What you have in Haiti is about 5% of the population controlling 60% of the wealth, with the top 1% controlling 50% of the wealth. Now, you'll say, yes, but it's probably the same thing in the US. And in Canada, the numbers might look the same. Possible. But in Haiti, 80% of the population lives in poverty, which means with less than $2 a day, and 65% in extreme poverty, which means less than $1 a day. So it is a system that, for all intent and purposes, is not different than what apartheid was in South Africa or in Zimbabwe. And the system could not continue. The masses did not want any part of that, and they knew that the only way they could change the system, what they had to put in its place, was one into really these masses that had been excluded for so long would actually wield the political power and could force the elite into a kind of negotiation, if you will, where the wealth distribution would be somehow less tilted, less unequal. Because, you know, after 200 years of independence, 50% of Haitians still could not read or write. And that 50%, you know, it is an understatement, because really those who succeed in acquiring the basic skills of reading and writing then have no material to maintain that ability, you know. So you might consider that an even greater percentage of Haitians are functionally illiterate. In fact, during the 10 years since President Aristide first assumed power, and really during the 5 years of Préval's first mandate, more public schools were built in Haiti than during the 190 years that preceded it. That gives you an idea of how much the elites cared about the national education. You should also know that in Haiti, 80% of children go to private school. So you imagine what burden it is for the poorest people to have to scrunch money to be able to send their kid to school. It's a disaster. So the system had to change. But the vision of the Haitian people and the vision of the US and of the elites were on a collision course. And that's why, in fact, since the Haitian people have started their struggle for democracy, there has been not two, but really three coups d'etats. In November 1987, when the first free election were supposed to be held, and when there was no Jean-Bertrand Aristide in sight as a candidate, the Haitian people were going to vote in some middle-of-the-line politician. But the thing was not who they were going to elect, but how. They were going to elect him themselves and then measure their own power. Because, of course, you cannot give power if you don't have it. So if the masses could pick someone and send him to be president, make him president, they would realize all the potential they had. And this could not be tolerated. And that's why on November 29, 1987, there was made what I call a preemptive coup. Since the person chosen by the people was going to be elected, the election had to be drowned in blood, and this was done on the day of the vote as the electorate was standing in line. So these elections were canceled. And after a brief episode when they tried to put a puppet civilian as president. They overthrew him 4 months later, and the military assumed power again. Of course, the Haitian people did not give up. And after getting rid of two military dictatorships, finally, once again, we were ready for election in December 1990. Everything was going fine. There was only one candidate, really, and he was the one picked by the U.S., one Marc Bazin. He was going to be elected because there was no candidate that the Haitian masses really trusted or that really embodied their dream of democracy. That is, until Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was a priest at the time, stepped up and declared his candidacy at the last moment, 2 months before election day. And suddenly, the whole equation was changed. People had not been registering. They started coming on in droves to the registration stations and registered in huge numbers. Obviously, there was a problem in the nice plan that had been drawn by the specialist in Washington or in Langley Forest. But they were not ready. They didn't have a contingency plan. So the election happened. And just as maybe some of you have seen, last February 7, 2006, Haitians came out in huge number and made sure people knew who they voted for, you know. Some of them went to the polling station with a rooster on their arm because Aristide's emblem was a rooster, or they would make a rooster cry, you know, a shout as they would come out of the polling station. Because one thing they didn't want was for people to play with numbers and void their vote through treachery. And not only did they do that, but the next day, they took to the street and proclaimed that Aristide had won the presidency. And true enough, when they started counting the vote, it was a complete landslide. Aristide got upward of 67% of the vote, and Bazin, who came in second, had 12%. So Aristide was president-elect, and he was supposed to be sworn in on February 7, 1991, because this is the constitutional date, February 7. However, the enemy had not given up. Not having been able to rig the election upstream, they went downstream to do what is called a democratic correction. They took an old thug from the Duvalier era, and on January 7, he stormed the National Palace, went on national TV, and announced that he had assumed power to stop the communists from taking over the country with Aristide. However, this plan was very poorly organized and did not take into account the level of mobilization in the Haitian masses. The minute that man made that announcement on TV, the whole country, in like half a second, was up on its feet in the middle of the night, and they took to the street. Nobody was ready for that. And before you could say amen, they were all over the what is called the Champ Mars. This is where you have the National Palace, the headquarters of the army, the ministries, etc., etc. And they surrounded the palace, they surrounded the headquarters of the army, and they were getting ready to storm the palace. In the meantime, the guy who had made this coup sent a team to assassinate Aristide. Unfortunately for him, Aristide had already left his house and gone to a safe place. So the coup had completely flopped. When the army saw that the masses were going to storm the palace, they had no choice, even though they were on to that coup, to go in and arrest the culprit. So plan B had failed also. Aristide was inaugurated on February 7, 1991, in an extraordinary atmosphere of hope, of enthusiasm. The street of Port-au-Prince, which is one of the most dirty capital that I know, were cleaned, so clean that you could really eat off them, you know, and decorated. And all of this was done by the people themselves without a penny, without heavy equipment. It was done with shovels and wheelbarrows, and the country on February the 7th was beautiful. The spirit was beautiful, and we seemed headed for a true change and for democracy. But there was a plan C. 7 months later, on September 30th, 1991, the army moved on the new government. When the people saw that, when the shooting started, the people thought they could renew what they had done on January 7th. They came out in large number again, but this time the army was ready. They started shooting at them with machine guns. They had this little armored personal carrier, and it was a real bloodbath, and Aristide was taken prisoner and sent into exile. However, the Haitian people did not give up. There comes a time in the life of a people that it's a historical moment and it cannot be stopped. It was the case back when the Haitians were going for freedom and independence. They could not be stopped when their time had come. And now that they are after democracy, they will not be stopped because their time has come. So Aristide went into exile. But the Haitian people, despite the repression of the army and the death squad that were formed by the CIA, the Haitian people kept resisting the coup. They did it so much that the country, for all intents and purposes, you know, stopped being manageable. The army had to resort to more and more blatant acts of barbarism. And in the meantime, in Washington, George Bush lost the presidency to Bill Clinton. And Clinton had, during his campaign, criticized Bush's policy toward Haiti, and he had no choice once he got in power but to change that policy. And to make a long story short, Aristide became, in October 1994, the only president who, after having overthrown by a military coup, was reinstated in power. Or should I say in the palace, because power is another thing. What happened is that the country he faced in October 1994 was not the country he went in the electoral campaign to lead. The country had been devastated by the years of the coup and the embargo which ensued. The grassroots movement has been decapitated by repression, exile, and, you know, the handing out of visa to the leaders to lure them out of the terrain. And also, the momentum had been broken. But nevertheless, Aristide came back, finished his mandate, a mandate that had been completely in shambles. You know, he did 7 months, then 3 years and some in exile, and then had, you know, like a year and some to take care of a country that was left, you know, bleeding and almost dying. So when people judge Aristide, they have to take that into account, which is never done. Nobody speaks of the first coup. They said Aristide, you know, had two mandates, but it's not true. He didn't even have one mandate out of the two mandates that the people gave him.